You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 7th of January 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Monocle's studios here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up on today's programme...
They're not refugee. They're not at all. They just come to work here. We don't need them here.
Yes, we can.
Yes, we can.
From protests in Tel Aviv to China in South Sudan, we'll review the day's top news stories with Martin Plaut and Rachel Shabby here in the studio. Then we meet the curator of a new exhibition focused on the greatest fakes and forgeries of the art world. All that plus we'll check in with our man in Ukraine and review Egypt's biggest international cultural event since the 2011 revolution. That's Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, starting right now on Monocle 24. So lots coming up in the next hour here on Midori House. But first, here's Bill Bingham with the latest news headlines from around the world.
Monocle 24 News. The first shipment of chemical weapons has been removed from Syria under a deal to rid the country of its chemical arsenal. The UN mission overseeing the disarmament has confirmed that a Danish vessel is en route to international waters carrying the material. Maritime security is being provided by naval escorts from China, Denmark, Norway and Russia. The chemicals are due to be transferred onto a US Navy ship and taken for destruction in a specially created titanium tank on board. The Iraqi government says its troops have killed 25 fighters linked to Al-Qaeda in Ramadi in an airstrike. But according to the Defence Ministry, an assault on Fallujah has been delayed because of fears over civilian casualties. The government lost control of Fallujah to Al-Qaeda militants and allied Sunni Arab tribesmen at the weekend. Japan has scrambled fighter jets to head off a Chinese government plane flying towards islands that are the source of tension between the two countries. The Chinese Y-12 propeller plane went into Japan's air defence identification zone, around 99 miles away from airspace surrounding the uninhabited Senkaku Islands, which Japan controls but Beijing claims as its own. Japanese officials say the aircraft turned back towards China without entering the contested airspace after the jets became airborne. Israel has published plans to build more homes in settlements in the occupied West Bank. The announcement came as US Secretary of State John Kerry concluded his 10th visit in a year, trying to forge an Israeli-Palestinian peace deal. Israeli settlements are built on occupied land and are considered to be illegal by the United Nations. The European Union is warning there could be more violence in South Sudan if no ceasefire is brokered between the rebels and government. Officials are urging other countries not to get involved in the dispute and say the volatile situation could easily degenerate and lead to a humanitarian crisis. South Sudanese rebels and a government delegation have started peace talks in Ethiopia to try to end fighting that's left the world's newest state on the brink of civil war. 3 weeks of violence have seen at least 1,000 people killed and 200,000 driven from their homes. South Sudan government chief negotiator Nial Deng Nial says they could agree to rebel demands for political prisoners to be released.
What has prompted them to come here is that they are facing some difficulties with the other side, which seems to be demanding that before they can have any meaningful discussions, the detainees have to be released. So in their meeting with His Excellency the President, what I just told you is what he told them, that basically he would be happy to set them free as long as the requisite legal processes have taken place.
More than half the population of the United States is under a wind chill warning as a blast of freezing Arctic air sweeps south and east across the country. The whirlpool of dense air, known as the polar vortex, has brought the coldest temperatures for decades and caused a number of deaths. Schools and businesses have been closed, thousands of flights have been cancelled, and several highly populated cities are facing temperatures colder than Siberia. Around 187 million people could eventually feel the effects of the freezing temperatures, and Americans have been warned their skin could freeze within minutes if they go outside. Russia's law enforcement agencies are on high alert in the Black Sea resort of Sochi as part of security measures for next month's Winter Olympics. President Vladimir Putin has boosted security in Russia following two suicide bomb attacks in the southern city of Volgograd just over a week ago, which killed at least 34 people. Local residents have complained about their city being transformed into a metal and steel metropolis. But this business visitor to Sochi, Nathan Wright, is happy with the measures.
I think it feels very good to feel safe where you are, and I think that is definitely a sense that we have here in Sochi, that we feel good, we feel safe.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Bill Bingham, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We're right back after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost, see on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. The time here is 18.06 in London, 13.06 in New York City. Joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio is Martin Plaut, fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies and a former Africa editor for the BBC World Service, and also Rachel Shabby, journalist and author of Not the Enemy, Israel's Jews from Arab Lands. Welcome both to the programme.
Thank you.
We're going to start in Tel Aviv, where migrants from mainly Sudan and Eritrea have been protesting in Tel Aviv, demanding that Israel grant them refugee status. Most of these migrants slipped into Israel through Egypt, and they number around 50,000. Israel has allowed them to stay but has not checked their refugee claims. In the last 2 weeks, immigration police began arresting them and taking them to a newly built detention facility in Israel's desert. In a moment, we'll be hearing from that protest today. But Rachel, if I can start with you. These have been quite extraordinary scenes we've seen over the past few days of thousands of African migrants protesting in Tel Aviv. And it's been an issue that's been bubbling along for quite some time. What do you think has really prompted it to reach this level now?
Yeah, it's an extraordinary protests. They're said to go across the African refugee community. So it's a very coordinated, collective attempt. And I suspect that that's what's happened. And what's really interesting about these protests is that they've given the African refugees a chance to have a platform and actually speak directly to the public. In the past few months, what we've seen, especially 2013, we saw a lot of kind of incitement and racism, very inflammatory remarks by Israeli ministers from the Israeli coalition government. You remember one Likud member of parliament, Miri Regev, Prime Minister Netanyahu's party, described the refugees as a cancer in Israel, and that was very representative of the way they were being spoken about by a lot of politicians. That spilled over onto the streets. We saw lots of violence against African refugees, people and property attacked. And now, because of these very coordinated protests, because we've seen, 20,000 refugees converge in Tel Aviv, they've actually had the chance to put their case to the public and say, look, we're not the enemy. We're not here to scare you or take your jobs. Please don't be afraid.
Martin Plaut, many of these refugees come from Sudan or they come from Eritrea. If you were trying to leave those countries, and many do try to go, Israel is one of the few places that is, and all these things are relative, but relatively easy to access, certainly far safer than trying to chance your arm on a boat to Europe.
Well, I'm not sure about that. It is hell to get there. Mm. Frankly, most of the Eritreans in particular, and about 60 or 70% of them are Eritreans, will have come across Sudan. Now, just to get into Sudan, they will have paid a hefty bribe to members of the Eritrean armed forces to cross the border, which is mined and is patrolled by people with guns with instructions to shoot. So they have to pay a bribe to get into Sudan. Once they're in Sudan, they then have to find a people trafficker who will take them into the Sinai, which is not an easy thing to do. And then they face the possibility that the people who they have already paid perhaps as much as $10,000, that they will then sell them to local Bedouin, who will then torture them in pits, giving them mobile phones and telling them to phone their relatives, either in Eritrea or in places like Canada, Britain, or wherever. And they will be tortured on the phone while they are in the pit and being told how much money they want. They get as much as $30,000 or $40,000 in excess to just get them to the border point, not even any further. So, I mean, these people have been through terrible, terrible things to get where they are, which is why they are so desperate.
Let's hear from some of those protesters now. Monocle contributor Daniela Cheslow was at the protest today, and she spoke with a few of them.
Freedom!
Levinsky Park is where most migrants from Africa first land in Tel Aviv, and often where they sleep their first nights. Today, thousands of Eritrean and Sudanese migrants are gathered here for the third day of their protest. Dawit Tesfe arrived in Israel from Eritrea 6 years ago.
I need from the Israel government to respect me, to give me legal refugee paper.
Well, Adin from Sudan said he expected better treatment in Israel.
I think Israel, like a democracy country like the United States and Canada. I came here, but I disappointment with the situation here.
He said the government has been calling the refugees names like cancer, garbage, or infiltrators.
The government, like always, no racist against us.
The new detention center has the migrants on edge, like Saad Epikodom, who came to Israel 6 years ago from Eritrea.
If you see a lot of police, and sometimes they came without police uniform. So sometimes you are afraid, yeah.
Migrant aid organizations say that Jews have a special obligation to help refugees. But other Israelis, especially residents of poor Tel Aviv neighborhoods that have been overwhelmed with impoverished African migrants, are less sympathetic. Sima Nisani lives in the neighborhood. She watched the protest from the street.
They're not refugees. They're not at all. They just come to work here. We don't need them here.
Yes, we can!
Yes, we can!
The African migrants say they will continue to protest until Israel changes its policies.
That was Daniela Cheslow in Tel Aviv. One of the most interesting voices there, Rachel Shabby, was from one of the Israelis there, and their view on, as she put, these so-called migrants, and, you know, we don't need them here, what are they doing here? Talk to us a bit about the image and the impression of migrants and refugees in Israel, because it would be very easy to assume that Israel, a country formed by refugees, would be incredibly sympathetic towards other refugees.
Yeah, that was very much my experience when I interviewed Israelis in South Tel Aviv about migrants and refugees. They would get very upset. Even when I use the word refugees, you know, get very angry about that. And the problem that Israel has is that it is very obsessed with this idea of demographics in a Jewish state. So even though it's a signatory to international conventions on the rights of refugees and human rights, when it comes down to it, it's very reluctant to give refugees any kind of official status in Israel. So what's happened is that these, you know, some 60,000 African refugees in Israel now, Israel's not only refused to consider most of their claims, but it also won't give them any kind of status. It won't give them employment rights, or much less citizenship, of course, because that would skew the demographics in Israel. As a result of which, you know, you see a lot of kind of abandoned, unemployed people, Africans in South Tel Aviv, creating the impression that, you know, there are a jobless demographic just in Israel to sponge off the state, you know, commit crime and so on. So it's a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy that the government has created. It hasn't given the refugees the capacity to become part of society, and therefore Israelis persist in this perception of that population.
Martin, if the world is willing to accept that there are certain regimes where people will want to escape from, and most liberal democracies will at least accept that, some would want to escape from Eritrea. Do you get any sense that anyone in any of these countries has a handle on a sensible way of dealing with that issue, other than just, shaking their heads and wringing their hands?
Well, let me just say one thing before I come on to that, which is that my father was a German Jew who was a refugee in South Africa. And he said in the 1930s that German Jews who'd arrived in South Africa treated black people within 6 weeks of them arriving, he said, in the same way. And when he used to question them about this, they said, oh, that's different. That's different from what we faced. So I'm afraid there's no surprise that people can treat people in this way. On the question of what can be done about it, the one suggestion by the Israeli government has at one time been that they should be actually sent to Uganda, which in a sense has its own irony, since there was a time when there was an idea that that the Jews of Europe would be sent to Uganda. But that has been
Madagascar
one of the suggestions.
Well.
Exactly,
yeah.
Or Madagascar. Yeah. But I don't think anyone really knows what to do. I mean, to be honest, there is no easy solution to these. And I'm relatively sympathetic to some of the right-wing Israeli positions, because, it isn't fun having these people on your doorstep. And, they have committed some crimes, and not many, but there are some, and every time somebody feels that they're under attack or that threat from a black population that they don't know anything about, they don't trust them, you can see why they're angry and concerned.
And Rachel Shabby, they're kind of not helped by their politicians using some very loaded language. You mentioned cancer. Another word that's been used is infiltrator.
Yeah.
Which has been used by Netanyahu. In fact, I'll come to you in a moment. A little bit earlier, we spoke with Ben Hartman from the Jerusalem Post about that word in particular. Here's him talking to Emma Nelson.
The Israeli media kind of varies. It's very common to see infiltrators, I would say most common, but you also see migrants, the Israeli word for migrants, or asylum seekers. You very rarely, if ever, see refugees. So by and large, I wouldn't say it's as hardcore in its terminology as the Israeli government, but they do tend to use that, and I think it reflects what is pretty much the predominant opinion among a majority of Israelis who don't see them, by and large, as legitimate refugees or asylum seekers. It's more common for people to see them as, let's say, migrant workers.
Why is that? Is it a problem that is perceived by the Israelis of people trying to come in to take their jobs, or is this something in the Israeli psyche?
I think it's hard to say. I don't think it's necessarily that they see them as coming in to take their jobs, because I don't think that they're taking jobs here that most Israelis would want to do. They're working the same type of jobs that poor third world migrants take all over the Western world. What worries people would be, what they talk a lot about, especially politicians, is demographic issues, Israel losing its Jewish character, people disrupting social services and neighborhoods. Most of them are concentrated in the tens of thousands in the very poorest sections of Tel Aviv. And so there, you do have an actual very real social issue, an infrastructure issue, and resources issue for the people who were there before them, after they've arrived there. But largely it does relate back to issues of identity and nationalism in Israel.
Rachel, that word infiltrator that Netanyahu's used, he's referred to illegal infiltrators here to work, which seems like a bit of a tautology. Where does that language come from? Why is it so vehement, do you think?
It comes from a description of Palestinians, actually. It has a long history in Israel. It was used immediately after the 48 war that created Israel and led to Palestinians being forced or fleeing from their homes. And when they tried to come back to their homes, they were labelled infiltrators. And that label has continued for Palestinians. So it's a particularly loaded word that conjures up images of, enemy, someone who's not supposed to be there. And that is exactly why it's being used to describe these African refugees, because of that association. But there is some truth in this idea that, most of these refugees, I think half of them, have ended up in South Tel Aviv, which is already a slum. It's basically had drug and prostitution problems, poverty and unemployment to begin with. So, of course, in a sort of socioeconomic terms, placing a large population of refugees in that area is going to create a kind of conflict and tension. And that partly explains, I think, the reaction that these refugees have faced.
We'll leave that discussion just there. We're going to be talking about China and Japan and their roles in Africa in just a moment. You're listening to Midori House.
The entrepreneur seeks out the seers, the sages, and the successes of the business world. Every week, we take you on an hour-long tour to uncover the hidden, extraordinary, curious, and inspiring stories you won't hear anywhere else.
I don't see any borders between countries, if it's in Japan, England, France. My approach is that I believe that people anywhere in the world, there are people who understand and appreciate it.
There's a push maybe that people want to have more of their stuff made locally because they know where it's coming from.
From the kiosk owners of Cairo to the coffee culture of Tel Aviv, from the beer brewers of Ghana to the piano makers of Greece. Intrigued? Well, tune in to hear how the best entrepreneurial minds tick, not just the ups and downs of the FTSE.
We didn't buy into a design studio or a commercial entity, we bought into a factory.
So, if you have an idea and want to drop that 9-to-5, you've just found your new business Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time, in association with Pictet.
Each week, Section D takes a thorough look at the design world. From fashion to furniture, from lighting to tasteful living, we'll bring you the most interesting news from design studios across the globe.
Where is society going? What is the furniture that will lead what society will want in terms of furniture functions and forms?
We see that more and more contemporary designers actually do not think about the mass-produced object. That's not what drives them. That's not what they're interested in. That's not what they think they want to contribute to this world.
You can't really create 240 years of a story. What I'm saying is the brand has incredible authenticity and creates integrity.
It's not just making clothes, but shoes and accessories and thinking about the character or the narrative of the collection.
Join me, Tom Morris, on Section D, your one-stop guide to the world of design.
That's Section D, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours London time, in association with Lexus.
And you're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me is Martin Plaut and Rachel Shabby. We're going to be looking at Asia in Africa right now. And first of all, Japan. On Thursday, Prime Minister Shinzo Abe plans to set off on a trip to Africa and the Middle East. He's going to visit Mozambique, Ethiopia, Cote d'Ivoire and Oman. Martin, we talk a lot about China in Africa, and indeed we will talk about China in Africa in a moment, less so about Japan, but actually Japan has been involved for a number of years with rather a lot of money.
Oh, it has indeed, and they certainly believe in putting money into Africa, you know, but it tends to be through aid, and they tend to operate rather like a Western government would. So that they would put in the aid and it would be up to the companies to do the investments, which is very different from the Chinese perspective, which is to say, well, you know, here we are, we're China. We come in and we operate in that kind of
way.
We
will build your roads and run your factories and we might build a hospital if you really want one.
Absolutely. And it is a very kind of different kind of approach. So although, and of course they are in competition with each other, I think that is the other thing to remember is that in a sense, the Japanese were there for a very much longer time. I remember, again, from a South African perspective, where the Japanese were honourable whites and the Chinese were seen as honorary blacks in South Africa under the old apartheid system. I mean, can you believe it? But that's actually how they used to be divided.
Indeed. And Rachel, when you look at the Japan's sort of influence in Africa, obviously, as Martin says, that they are in competition with China in a sense. But do you think there's also something in that of Japan wanting to remind the rest of the world that it is still, despite all its problems, it is still you know, one of the largest economies in the world, and it does take its those responsibilities relatively seriously.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely a component, and it is interesting to see how the two countries are approaching it. I mean, Japan is almost trying to say, well, we can't match the quantity of China, which has been throwing money at the region for quite some time, but we qualitatively, we're different. You know, we won't barge in and tell you what to do. We won't bring our own workforce and make them stay there. We're actually listen to you and we'll do what you want. And before anyone thinks this is a bit of a, you know, we're treating Africa as a country, it's, from what I understand it, Japan hasn't actually decided which countries it wants to invest in. Like, they're kind of bidding for Japan's attention. But it's interesting to see the ones that it is looking more closely at. Somalia, because it's interested in the sea route. Kenya, because, of again, with Mombasa being a port. So it's clear that it's not just a financial thing here. It is wanting to punch its weight as a global player. It wants sort of geostrategic and geopolitical influence too.
And Martin, let's now talk about China and specifically its role in South Sudan. China has always made clear that it doesn't want to ever interfere in the internal affairs of a sovereign nation, mainly also because it then doesn't want anyone to interfere in its own internal affairs,
exactly,
particularly in Tibet or indeed elsewhere. But with South Sudan and the situation there, where you've had several weeks now of fighting and this huge split within the government and more importantly within the army, South Sudan is a huge producer of oil, which China likes to buy a lot of. What do you make of China's decision to publicly say the two sides need to sort this out?
Well, in a sense, they are stuck between the devil and the deep blue sea, the Chinese, because they have their own people on the ground in the oil fields. That oil can only get out through North Sudan, or Sudan as it's now called, but the oil feeds actually are in South Sudan. So they have to keep on both good terms with both sides of this.
So, and now they need to keep on both sides of both sides? Or
I think that they are keen to keep on both sides of the two governments. Mm. I think that they are not at all keen on Riek Machar and the way that he is going. And it's interesting that you've had Omar al-Bashir has come down to the government, the president of Sudan has been in Juba trying to, you know, smooth the waters. And there are even suggestions that there will be a joint force to patrol the border and in sense to try and ensure security in the oil fields. Because from both countries' point of view, both countries get almost all their revenue from the oil. They both want to get that oil out. The Chinese also want to get the oil out because it's a source of oil for the Chinese. And the only way of doing that is to ensure that there's security and, in a sense, in defeating Riek Machar.
And for a long time, there have been tensions and worries, and most of the focus has been on relations between Sudan and Khartoum and South Sudan and those two governments. And there's been all sorts of issues over those two getting on or really not getting on since they became independent. It's a little strange, isn't it, that this situation in the south has actually sort of pushed those two governments, which didn't really like each other, far closer together.
Well, it has. Yes, that's precisely the point. There is, of course, one nightmare for the Chinese, which is that perhaps the oil will no longer go through the north, but will begin to go through Uganda, and then from Uganda either be sold in the region or refined in Uganda and sold in the region, or in fact piped out through a ports that the Kenyans are trying to build on the coast up near Lamu. Now, if that happens, then the Chinese might lose control of what they have now, which is a nice fat source of oil that they really have, you know, their hands on. So I think they're very worried about what is going on.
And Rachel, just briefly, in a sense, is this China realizing that their foreign policy has to be a little bit more flexible than it has been in the past?
Well, it's just a case of finances trumping any sort of political edicts that you might have issued in the past. I mean, it's clear, as Martin says, that, you know, that it's imperative for them to sort it out because of their, you know, that their influence with the oil there. And it's also clear that they seem a little bit exasperated with how slow things are going. You know, these peace talks that are being carried out in Ethiopia at the moment. Clearly, China's going, well, look, this has taken too long. You need to sort it out now. And it's kind of muscling in as a way of getting them to speed things up, I think.
And Martin, just finally on South Sudan, have you seen any rays of hope in the past few days at all that make you think that something might change?
Not a lot. I mean, the only tiny ray of hope is that Mrs. Garang, the widow of the previous leader of South Sudan, has come out really trying to get the two sides together. She's the only person who has the legitimacy who might be able to do it. But apart from that, no. I mean, you know, people are fighting and there's a lot more fighting to be done, I think, and a lot more dying too.
Martin Plaut and Rachel Shabby, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you both very much indeed for joining us here on Midori House.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London, this is Monocle 24.
Op London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
Plenty still to come then in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll check in with our man in Ukraine, where apparently it's Christmas Day, would you believe? We'll also get the latest on a travelling art show for forgeries, and we'll review the Cairo International Book Fair. But first, here's Bill Bingham with the news headlines.
The first shipment of chemical weapons has been removed from Syria under a deal to rid the country of its chemical arsenal. The UN mission overseeing the disarmament has confirmed that a Danish vessel is en route to international waters carrying the material. The chemicals are due to be transferred onto a US Navy ship and taken for destruction in a specially created titanium tank on board. The Iraqi government says its troops have killed 25 fighters linked to Al-Qaeda in Ramadi in an airstrike. But according to the Defence Ministry, an assault on Fallujah has been delayed because of fears over civilian casualties. Japan has scrambled fighter jets to head off a Chinese government plane flying towards islands that are the source of tension between the two countries. The Chinese Y-12 propeller plane went into Japan's air defence identification zone around 99 miles away from airspace surrounding the uninhabited Senkaku Islands, which Japan controls but Beijing claims as its own. Israel has published plans to build more homes in settlements in the occupied West Bank. The announcement came as US Secretary of State John Kerry concluded his 10th visit in a year, trying to forge an Israeli-Palestinian peace deal. Israeli settlements are built on occupied land and are considered to be illegal by the United Nations. The European Union is warning there could be more violence in South Sudan if no ceasefire is brokered between the rebels and government. Officials are urging other countries not to get involved in the dispute and say the volatile situation could easily degenerate and lead to a humanitarian crisis. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Bill Bingham, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House live here on Monocle 24. The time is 18:33 in London and 16:33 in Rio. Time now to check in with one of our correspondents from around the world. And today we head to Kharkiv, the second largest city in Ukraine, where our man there, Gulliver Craig, is apparently celebrating Christmas Day. Gulliver, congratulations.
Well, I haven't been celebrating Christmas myself. I celebrated it on the 25th of December, but most Ukrainians are either Orthodox Christians or Greco-Catholics, and both those strands of Christianity celebrate on the 7th of January, or rather on the evening of the 6th.
Before we talk about the more serious things that have been going on in Ukraine, what has Christmas been like this year in Kharkiv?
Well, in Kharkiv, I think it's been a reasonably normal Christmas. You should underline that Ukrainians and people in the former Soviet Union generally are a lot bigger on New Year than they are on Christmas. It's the religious people who really celebrate Christmas, and the sort of commercial, non-religious Christmas is creeping in, but it hasn't that much. But Kharkiv isn't at the epicenter of the protest movement that's been gripping Ukraine for the last 7 weeks. Kiev is, and there I know that the protesters were occupying the central square. Some of them were still camped out, probably hundreds, I would say, were camped out on Christmas night there. And obviously they had to have their traditional Christmas meal, which in Ukraine consists of 12 vegetarian dishes. And since these protests started, volunteers have been providing food to the protesters, and they went the whole hog and produced these 12 vegetarian dishes. So you can imagine that must have been quite an operation, dishing all of that out to the hundreds of people, protesters camped out there.
Yes, quite a catering operation. Now, Kharkiv is the second largest city in Ukraine, and it's in the east, which, you know, it's a Russian-speaking part of Ukraine, has always been a little less pro-European, and back during the heady days of the Orange Revolution almost 10 years ago, it was seen as Yanukovych's heartland. Is it still seen as his heartland? Has he got a lot of support there, or has there been protests there too?
Well, Viktor Yanukovych's support all over the east and south of Ukraine has definitely reduced, but people here do speak Russian. They're industry is very much tied to the Russian economy. Their factories export to Russia. They have good reasons to really want Ukraine to maintain good ties with Russia. So even though they're not all that keen on Viktor Yanukovych as a leader, they've been a lot more reticent in the east of Ukraine generally to join the protest movement. But there is a very, very active group of protest leaders who are meeting every day. Every evening they meet about 300 people in a park in the center of Kharkiv, and then on weekends I'm told that there are more people who gather, so that there is a pro-European movement, and they're trying very, very hard to attract more people to it, but it certainly hasn't sort of caught fire in the way that it did in Kiev and also in most of the west of Ukraine.
And when we look at the protests overall, they're now in their seventh week. Do you get the sense that they are running out of steam at all, that we've sort of reached a slightly unsatisfactory status quo?
Well, I don't think the status quo is satisfactory to the protesters, but there have certainly been a lot fewer people protesting on Independence Square in the center of Kiev over the last couple of weeks. But everyone you speak to there tells you that that's just because it's Christmas and people have gone home for the holidays, and as soon as the holiday season is over, so I guess next Sunday will be the next big protest, we'll see tens of thousands of people again. I spoke to Vitali Klitschko, one of the opposition leaders, on Sunday, and he said, oh, you'll be surprised, people will be back in their tens of thousands. But they are, of course, a bit disheartened, because Viktor Yanukovych hasn't really given any concessions to what the protesters have been demanding. I mean, even in terms of releasing protesters who were arrested, he hasn't even done that. He passed an amnesty law saying he would release people who were arrested, but he hasn't released anybody. He went right ahead and didn't sign the deal with the European Union that the pro-European protesters wanted, and signed instead a number of economic agreements with Russia that we still don't know the details of, but which do involve a Russian loan to Ukraine of more than $15 billion, which people generally seem to think is at least going to be enough to tide Viktor Yanukovych over until the elections in 2015, though it certainly doesn't solve the country's underlying economic problems. And so it's not really clear how the protesters can unseat Viktor Yanukovych or what their plan really is. But at the same time, there are still thousands of them there. They're still extremely determined. And I think for the opposition leaders, they don't really see that there's any turning back.
Well, indeed, I that's why I wonder whether they have any sort of strategy, or, I mean, because obviously, you know, the opposition leaders are themselves a pretty sort of odd coalition. They won't necessarily be comfortable partners if they were ever in power. When you've been talking to them, do they have any idea of what they're going to do next, or do they keep on saying, no, don't worry, this strategy is going to work, this tactic is going to work?
Well, first of all, they constantly put on a show of great unity between the three opposition leaders. Vitali Klitschko, who's the most popular as an individual, but who's still an absolutely terrible public speaker. Then Arseniy Yatsenyuk, who leads the biggest opposition party while Yulia Tymoshenko is in jail. And then Oleg Tsianibok, who leads this rather worrying nationalist far-right party, Svoboda, which is heavily overrepresented among the protesters. You're absolutely right. They're three very, very different people, and I don't think they would get on once they're in power. They say, though, that the solution to that is they will all three stand in the next presidential elections, and then whoever gets through to the second round will be the one who stands against Viktor Yanukovych, and that will be the one who wins. It's not really a very satisfactory plan for them to have announced, because it shows that they haven't even been able to agree on a sort of unified opposition candidate. The one new thing, the sort of new noise that I heard actually Arseniy Yatsenyuk making, which a lot of people had been saying he should say for a long time, is that Viktor Yanukovych actually in 2010 changed the constitution in a way that a lot of political experts and legal experts say was illegal. And according to that, you could make the argument that he therefore isn't the legitimate president and that therefore there ought to be new early elections. There's a sort of legal basis for calling for early elections. And in fact, that argument stands. But the problem is they didn't make it at the beginning of the protests. They didn't really make it in 2010, and they've been dealing with him since then. So in a way, it's a bit too late to start saying that. But apparently, they're going to try and mount that kind of legal challenge to his presidency.
Gulliver Craig in Kharkiv, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House. Up next, we'll discover the greatest fakes and forgeries of the art world and why we should perhaps appreciate them a little bit more.
Stand back from your letterboxes and tone up your biceps, because the biggest ever issue of Monocle is about to hit subscribers' doormats and newsstand shelves. The December-January issue helps you bid farewell to 2013 and look over the horizon to 2014 with our soft power survey, the Monocle 100, and our travel top 50.
In the affairs section, we sit down for a series of interviews with global heavy hitters, from the President of Chile to the Australian Foreign Minister. We take a look at the Mexican President's to-do list, look at Japan's agenda for 2014, and ask 10 writers, academics and economists to give us their predictions for the year to come.
In the business section, we visit three model factories that are working inspirations for their industries. From a shoelace factory in Hanover built by the early modernist Walter Gropius, to a restored Renaissance village in Umbria making knitwear, and a Japanese brand that's so transparent, its customers are invited to pitch their tents on the lawn outside. These are companies who've created beautiful, light-filled environments for their production lines and are reaping the benefits as a result.
The Monocle December-January double issue is on newsstands now.
Are you tired of overcooked and overrated culinary trends that never quite hit the spot? Fed up of being spoon-fed half-baked ideas on the next big thing? Then tune into The Menu with me, Markus Hippi. Every week we introduce you to the world's top makers and shakers, cocktail creators and the best bread makers, as we uncover gourmet street food, big-time baristas and wily wineries.
Once upon a time it was seen with disdain, but over the years that culture had gotten so popular it's iconic now.
If you're serving decent food in East London, I don't think you've got any problem getting custom in. And I worked in the West End for years, you know. I mean, it's not always packed in the West End, trust me.
This is the show that discovers how coffee can change a country and how chocolate can make us live longer, all in the search for exciting local food producers and the most original entrepreneurs.
That's The Menu, every Friday at 1900 hours London time.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, broadcasting live from Midori House here in London. Were a forgery to find its way into an art gallery, it would not normally be a cause for celebration. But the curator behind the exhibition, Intent to Deceive, believes there is something to admire about the fakers and forgers that have bedeviled the art world for centuries. Imitation Miros, phony Vermeers and false Philip DeLazlos are hung alongside the real thing. Colette Lowell, the exhibition's curator, joins us now from Washington, D.C. Colette, thank you very much for joining us today. Do you believe that many of these forgeries deserve to be seen as great art in themselves?
Well, I think that's a great question. It's always been controversial, and it's certainly subjective. I think that these works are really, more importantly, very important cultural artifacts. And from an art historical perspective, they do have significance in the art market, because they do tell us a lot about the art market. And we know that forgeries and fakes have been a prolific problem for centuries. And so now we have these artifacts to give us a better understanding as how and why these particular forgers were successful.
And when you look at some of the great forgers, as it were, are you surprised that some of them are so good that they didn't do their own work and try and stand on their own feet as an artist?
Well, I think that's there's a common thread between a lot of them. It's these frustrated artistic ambition, and you know, there's certainly a commonality between the five forgers that I profile in this exhibition, and some of them were mildly successful, some of them were not at all successful, but in each case, it seems that they were successful at a genre of art that was not contemporary. And so they found that they were much better at duplicating an era, a bygone era, if you will, than they were at kind of maintaining popular taste.
And when you have been looking at some of these works, I mean, you say you know, you're looking at some of the greatest forgers. Who are the ones that really stand out for you as having the most fascinating backstory?
Oh, well, all of those that I profile in the exhibit, but of course, Han van Meegeren, I mean, that is probably one of the most infamous forgers and probably the most important case of the fallibility of experts. And why I like that so much is because, of course, the experts got that one really wrong. And when we look at these paintings now, we have to really scratch our heads and wonder how could they have ever been mistaken for Vermeers. But at the time, the experts were absolutely convinced that they were authentic. And so for me, the backstory of not only how this individual artist created these works, and we know from a lot of the press and a lot of the books that have been written about van Meegeren, he was very precise in his creation of these. I think it took him about 4 years to develop a methodology and a formula for creating his paintings. But the backstory is so interesting because it involves also how they were actually accepted into the art market and what the machine was or what the mechanism was at the time, which included experts that had to, of course, authenticate them and accept them as Vermeers.
Indeed.
So the whole story is fascinating.
Now, in some of these cases, you've got the original that you're hanging up right next to the fake. Do you say which one is which and leave it for, or do you leave it for us to work out?
Well, that's a great question. We struggled with how to hang in when we were designing the exhibition. And so each forger has a section, but then at the end of the exhibition, we do have a test section, if you will, of comparisons, and we ask the museum visitor to choose which one that they think is the real and which is the inauthentic work. So we do that.
How do people do on the whole?
Well, it hasn't opened yet. The show opens on the 21st in Springfield, Massachusetts at the Springfield Museum. And so the show will be open to the public on the 21st of January.
Okay, but more importantly then, how did you do? Have you done this test yourself?
Well, I'm intimately familiar with each of these works, so I have to say I pegged it each time. But I'm not so sure that everybody would have the same success rate. So we've given the viewer, through the didactic panels and through the labels on each individual work, some clues and some ideas to how they can determine fake from a fake versus a forgery versus an authentic work. So fake and a forgery are two different things.
Indeed, indeed. Colette Lowell, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you very much for joining us. That's Colette Lowell, curator of Intent to Deceive, Fakes and Forgeries in the Art World. You can see that in Oklahoma City. You can see that in Sarasota, Florida. You can see it in Ohio. And also, she said, Springfield, Massachusetts. We're going to have a bit of music now. We just heard about fake art. Let's stay on that track. From Wales, this is Marina and the Diamonds with their song Lies. Marina and the Diamonds with Lies here on Midori House on Monocle 24. We'll be looking at the Cairo Book Fair next. So we're fast approaching the end of the programme. Before we go, time for our daily review segment, where we go through the best in books, theatre, arts, music and cinema with our correspondents and contributors from around the world. And today, as it's Tuesday, we talk books. Though it's still a couple of weeks away, we thought we'd take a look at the movers and shakers at the 43rd Cairo International Book Fair. It's the first such event to be held since the Egyptian Revolution in 2011. Joining us now for more is Monocle's Eastern Mediterranean correspondent, Joseph Dana. Joseph, thank you very much for joining us today. Give us a little bit of a background to this fair, because it's often considered or talked about as the most important literary event in the Arab world.
Absolutely. It really is the most important literary event. First off, it's just incredibly massive. In 2006, it was actually the second largest book fair in the world behind the Frankfurt Book Fair. And so this year, they're expecting about 755 publishers from 24 different countries. Now, curiously, they are expecting countries that have had, let's say, rocky diplomatic relations with Egypt since the military coup last summer to attend. So Turkey and Qatar are both expected to attend this year, and Kuwait is going to be the honorary kind of guest at this year's book fair because of Kuwait's incredibly savvy ability to print a large number of books at a very, very discounted rate. And so they're really kind of promoting Kuwait's ability to kind of open the arms of Arabic literature throughout the region.
Let's talk about some of the authors who it'll be worth going to see, the people that already draw in the crowds. Let's start with Omar Taher. What can you tell us about him?
Right. Omar Taher is really, he's really a journalist. I think that my personal feeling, and I've interviewed him before, is that he will, in fact, blossom into a writer at some point or another. But his writing has really kind of captured the intensity of the very fluid situation in Egypt as it's unfolded over the last 2 years. And I believe that we have a small clip reading from his latest work called the Qasr al-Ani Ambush, in which he collects a lot of his journalism over the last 2 years and really takes a look at the middle-class protesters that have been on the streets battling for Egypt's future.
I would walk around its streets during the revolution and sit in its small cafes with friends. Socialist ideologies dominate the souls of downtowners. It's not a utopia, but it's a conglomeration of artists and the intelligentsia of the capital.
That's an extract from Omar Taher's Qasr al-Ani Ambush. Joseph, they're also, you know, Omar Taher is one of the younger generation, one of the newer generation of writers. But obviously, Egypt's literary tradition goes back many, many years. And some of the older writers will also be represented at the fair.
Absolutely. And one of my personal favorites, who's gotten a lot of attention since the revolution, especially in the Western press, is Son'ala Ibrahim. Now, Son'ala Ibrahim is one of the last greats of the 1960s generation in Egyptian fiction, which was really dealing with their own revolution. In fact, the Nasser revolution in the 1950s. And his book, That Smell, which is a very curious title, it's a small novella explaining the kind of, let's say, the life of a political prisoner that just got out of one of Nasser's prisons. And, you know, one of the tests of really great literature is if it can stand the test of time. And reading That Smell these days, it looks like you're getting a kind of a vision into what's going on in Egypt currently. And I think that Son'ala Ibrahim's generation is very much, you know, like you said, the kind of foundation of Egyptian fiction. And another one of his contemporaries, Taha Hussein, will have a major reprint of many of his works during the book fair this year.
And a final one to watch is Ala al-Aswani, who some people outside of Egypt may now know for his columns in the International New York Times.
Absolutely. I think that if we look at Egyptian fiction now, we've kind of walked through the new, younger generation that's very influenced by the current events that are really shaping Egypt as we speak. We also look at the foundational generation, Son'ala Ibrahim in the 60s generation, and we have Al-Aswani, who's really become a bridge between Egypt and Egyptian and Arabic fiction and the West. And we have a clip of him explaining some of those transitions.
What you know in the West about the Arab world is what the international media see it as a convenient thing to tell you. And this is a big problem. But I believe that in Egypt, as a matter of fact, there are two struggles. going parallel to the political struggle. It's a struggle to defend the Egyptian tolerance, as you say, against the negative interpretation of the religion. And I insist, it is a negative interpretation of the religion and not the religion itself, because we have had a very tolerant interpretation of the Islam for centuries in Egypt.
Ala al-Aswani speaking there. Joseph, just finally and briefly, this is not necessarily a great time for the Arab literary scene when we look at the way it's considered elsewhere in the Arab world, is it?
No, not at all. And I think that, like I've been saying, that there's a certain transition that's going on in the Arab world, that literature is a slow process. It needs time to kind of let these events sink in. And so the book fair this year, I think, is in a situation in which it's trying to assist in the fermentation of some of these ideas, so that maybe in 5 years we're going to see Omar Tahir and other writers really emerge with that kind of narrative voice that is necessary to capture exactly what's going on the streets and create something that something like Sonella Ibrahim's generation was able to create, in which we could read it 40 years on. And so it's an exciting time to have a book fair. It's exciting that that books are being discussed. You know, right now the Arab world is not in the best position when it comes to books. And so I think that it will be looked upon in generations to come as a very transitional period.
Joseph Dana, Monocle's Eastern Mediterranean correspondent, thank you very much indeed. And we'll, of course, be covering the Cairo International Book Fair here on Monocle 24 in a couple of weeks' time. That's it for today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to Martin Plaut and Rachel Shabby. The show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Alexa Firminich and Hayley Joel Ott, and our studio manager was Alex Funnell. After me, it's Section D. We'll see how Taipei can take on its role as World Design Capital in 2016 and find out how good design can help cities prepare themselves for natural disasters. The Monocle Daily is on later. Midori House is back here, same time tomorrow, 1800 hours in London. But for us here, thank you very much for listening. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Goodbye.
It tells the story of a passion for motor racing, a legend forged over time by the pioneers of speed and great drivers. The Daytona Cosmograph, the watch made to break barriers, the watch dedicated to endurance. The watch that was born to race. Rolex.